Okay, so I think we're recording. Can you still hear me?
I can, yep. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, perfect. All right, so I'm here with Nick Lamb, the online sleep coach. And yeah, Nick and I met at Joel Jamison's BioForce Coaches Weekend. He presented on sleep, and I was really intrigued by a lot of the things that he said, and actually came back and started putting some things into practice that I want to talk to him about as we get into it. But I wanted to have him on so he could share some more insights about sleep and how it can impact everybody's performance and health and all that stuff. So, Nick, appreciate your time.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, man. So like I said, you are among other things a sleep coach. And to be honest with you, before you presented at the weekend there, the seminar, I hadn't really thought of or heard of a sleep coach before. So why don't we start off with kind of your story, a little bit of your background and how you got into the sleep coaching thing.
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely not something that people are used to hearing. Sleep coaching is not something that's typically very prevalent. Hopefully that's something aiming to change. So I've been a trainer and strength coach for about the last 7 or 8 years. I was always fascinated more by the health side of things, kind of embracing the role of being a healthcare practitioner, viewing things through the lens of health first. And obviously that came with having a lot of conversations about the things that people do outside of the gym, sleep being obviously a big.
Component of that. At the same time, I was also doing a lot with heart rate variability tracking, thinking that it would be in the context solely of my training. But what I found was that it was really all the other variables that impacted heart rate variability. And heart rate variability, for those that don't know, is just a basically objective measurement of your health that you can track on a regular basis. And sleep in particular was the thing that impacted heart rate variability the most, both in the short term and the long term. So it really got me into taking a really deep dive into sleep. And then, lastly, I think I just became fascinated with how little attention that sleep got relative to exercise and nutrition. People always talk about those being the three pillars of health. And I looked at sleep and again the little amount of attention that it was getting relative to those other things, and I looked at it as really just an opportunity to kind of find a niche. And I looked at sleep as requiring the same elements of coaching as exercise and nutrition, right? It requires guidance, it requires accountability, it requires a lot of the same things. So
Yeah, no, I think that the one of the things that you said early on in your presentation that really perked up my ears and got me more interested was you made the comment that sleep is the one lever that you can pull that will impact everything else. And when I thought about it, I was like, well, holy crap, he's right. Like everything that you can think of, whether it's performance or hormones or immunity or just well-being or whatever it is, you can lack of sleep will impact it negatively, and improving your sleep will improve it. And that yeah, like I said, was really stood out to me and got me thinking like, wow, this is this low-hanging fruit that everyone can take advantage of, but we're really not doing. So it kind of sounds like that was kind of your insight as well.
Yeah, exactly. It's been very much neglected. And if you think about the other things that we have to do for our health and our wellness and our well-being, I think sleep is definitely the most pleasurable of all those things as well. I think no one doesn't enjoy a good night of sleep. So when you talk about the things that you can do for your health, sleep is the most pleasant. And like you touched on, it impacts every single system of the body, right? Both mind and body. There really isn't anything that sleep doesn't influence in some way. So regardless of what someone's goals are, if sleep isn't a box that's checked off, they're going to have a lot harder of a time accomplishing their goals.
Yeah, I think that's something that a lot of people discount. So I guess kind of in that vein, what are, I guess we'll start off like with some of the negative impacts. I mean, what would you say like the top three negative impacts that lack of sleep has on people?
Sure. So not to promote, sleep health through fear, but really not many things are going to impact your health more than a lack of sleep. So, firstly, there's just the correlation between sleep and all-cause mortality, even when controlling for a lot of other variables. So there's a lot of large studies that have been done where they show that if you sleep too little, you have more of a chance of dying from any disease. And also, conversely, if you sleep too much, you also have an increased risk of dying from disease. So there really is a sweet spot, which is where a lot of that kind of 7 to 8 hours comes from.
Okay.
And then branching off of that really is the relationship between sleep and a bevy of chronic diseases. So everything from heart disease to Alzheimer's to cancer, there's correlative studies with sleep and with sleep loss over time. So, sleep also diminishes your immune system, and promotes more susceptibility to illness, whether it's acute illness or chronic illness, like we talked about. So things even just like cold and flu, you're much more susceptible to when you're not getting optimal sleep. The next piece is cognitive health and function. And I think this is an area where people don't even realize how many facets of how you function, are potentially impaired by sleep. So your focus levels, your ability to regulate your emotions, your judgment, your mental abilities. Sleep is going to directly impact your body composition and your metabolic regulation. And then another thing that I touch on a lot with people, which is something that really gets swept under the rug, is drowsy driving. So drowsy driving can be just as impactful as drunk driving and actually produces even more accidents and more deaths. It's an estimated 8,000 people die each year due to drowsy driving. And drought, for example, driving on 5 hours of sleep, which is something that a lot of people may be able to resonate with, actually makes you 4 times more likely to get into a crash or any kind of accident.
Yeah, that was I remember there's a book, was it Matthew Walker? I think.
Exactly. Why we sleep?
And he was on the Joe Rogan podcast, and that was my first like eye-opening, like holy crap, like sleep isn't like really an option. It really is a necessity. But when he talked about that in the micro sleeps, right? Like that's what it's referring to. So like I guess like people
Exactly.
probably aren't aware of what that is. So why don't you explain to people like why is drowsy driving dangerous? Because they're probably sitting there thinking like, I know I'm tired, but it's not
Right.
like that big of a deal. So like, yeah, what are micro sleeps and why are they so scary?
Yeah, so the micro sleeps specifically are scary because they can only be a few seconds, which is obviously all it really takes when you're on the road, but most of the time, people don't even realize that it's happening. So microsleep is usually anywhere from a second to 3 or 4 seconds where you're dozing off at the wheel. I think this comes back to the idea that people tend to be pretty poor at self-estimating not only their sleep and their sleep quality, but how they function when they're not sleeping. So their alertness, their ability to focus, even outside of just the micro sleeps, just the impaired ability and impaired alertness, when you're sleep deprived, even mild sleep deprivation, really just puts you at a significant risk when you're driving, even more so than if you've had a couple drinks, which is scary.
No, it is. Like he was anyways, yeah. So this isn't like you said, don't want to promote good sleep health through fear, so we won't hammer this point. But that was one of those things that I'd never thought about before. And when he said it and you realize like, holy crap, like that is happening and that is a scary thing. So, living in a
Sure.
society that is perpetually sleep deprived. And then you add in the fact that people are driving and they're paying more attention to their phones than they are the road anyways. And
It's a double-edged sword, yeah.
ooh, man,
So
I'm waiting for those
very
self-driving cars, baby. I used to be against them, but now I'm like public safety demands it.
Take it out of people's hands.
Yeah, humans are losing their ability to function properly on the road. So, but anyways, we'll round this back to performance and stuff. So definitely a lot of things you touched on there. Things people should consider. But what are, would you say, some of the top benefits? So say that someone's not getting enough sleep, and then they do improve their sleep, or something we'll touch on, like they're getting enough sleep time wise, but they don't have very good sleep habits or sleep hygiene, and so their sleep quality is not very high. And so if somebody takes some of the steps that we're going to talk about later and improves their sleep, what are some of the positive benefits that they can expect to see from that?
Yeah. So, just going back for a second, what I've found is people have a new baseline that's set when they're not getting optimal sleep. And because they don't really realize that, and they tend to be, poor at self-estimating their sleep, they've kind of forgotten what it feels like to, not need a cup of coffee right upon waking, or, to have full energy through, throughout most of the day, and all the things that come with that. So, good sleep, even just slight improvements in sleep quality, are going to help people in more ways than they really typically appreciate. Everything down to really the very person that you are. And I think this is something that people will probably experience, but your patience, how you interact with the ones you love, from a health standpoint, I like to look at it as it's your best life insurance policy. And from a performance standpoint, which we'll talk a little more about, I look at it as really your best natural performance enhancement drug. We can talk, a lot more about the specific variables of performance and how sleep impacts each one of those, but it really impacts everything across the board. So when we truly optimize our sleep, we function the way that we're supposed to.
Yeah, that's a really good point, man. Again, we forget. That's one of the things that I really like about, Joel and his course, and what he emphasizes, is that you have to look at things beyond just your training, and in this case, training and riding with mountain bikers, and understand how everything has an impact on your results. And so
you have to be healthy first. And this is why, this is part of what got me down this rabbit hole, was you have to look at things through the lens of health first, right? If you're not healthy, and I think sleep is a really important tenet of that, if you're not healthy, you're going to have a lot harder time performing, and you're much more likely to end up injured or breaking down when you're trying to perform as well. So
yeah,
you have to check the box of health first. And I think there's not many more things that are better for that than truly optimizing your sleep.
Yeah, no, I would totally agree. As a recovering freaking meathead in the gym who did not think that health was such an important thing, you start to realize eventually that you do have to take that into account, and it is a big part of it. And especially, something I really try to emphasize to the riders that I work with is that, you're getting into this for the long term. Like, one of the things I do jiu-jitsu as well, and one of the things I love about jiu-jitsu is that when you walk on the mat day one, they're like, dude, it's going to be 10 years before you get a black belt. And even that's like just you starting to get things figured out. Like, you come in with this expectation, sure, that you're going to have to spend years and years and years and years doing this. And so you realize really quickly, one of the most important things is your durability and your ability to not get hurt. And so just your health starts to realize, like, man, if I'm hurt all the time, I can't see this journey out. And so same thing with mountain biking and anything really, is that it's a marathon, not a sprint. And that if you don't look at it that way and do the things that are gonna impact you in the long term. And so, but yeah, it's one of those tough things, man, because people are like, oh, I can skip a little sleep today and do something that seems more productive in the moment without realizing you're screwing your future self by doing exactly that. So
yeah, it's difficult. It's difficult for us as coaches to really empower people and get people to buy into playing the long game,
Yeah. Yeah. That was one of, was it, anyways, yeah, without getting too far off the track there. But yeah, that book, Sapiens, yeah, I'm sure you read that book.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and one of the things that he talked about in there was like one of our superpowers as humans is that we can project, we can affect our future selves. Like we understand that we can do something today that will have an impact on our future self. And so like that's that idea of like, you know, is what you're doing today screwing your future self over, or is your future self going to be pumped that you're doing the things that you're doing today? And sleep is one of those things that future self is definitely going to be impacted by. So use that superpower, people, and think about future self when you're thinking about these things. But anyways,
absolutely.
A little off topic. So, all right. So now that we've kind of touched on some of the reasons people, just kind of general reasons people should be interested in good sleep, let's dig into that term a little bit more. I mean, how would you define quote unquote good sleep?
Yeah. So I think people tend to think of this too much in terms of duration and amount of sleep. And they tend to quantify their sleep and quantify whether or not they got good sleep based on how much sleep they got, or even sometimes how much they were actually in bed, which just because you were in bed 8 hours doesn't necessarily mean that you actually slept 8 hours. So, you know, the duration is definitely important, but we're learning more and more about the quality of sleep and why and how important that is, right? So actually, Matthew Walker defines four pillars that I think really paint the picture of what defines good sleep. And if you shortchange any one of these variables, you don't see the same benefits to sleep, and you may end up seeing some of the deficits in mind and body. So these four pillars are: first is quality of sleep, right? So the quality and depth of sleep. The second is quantity, so quantity is still important. The third is continuity, right? So are you having fragments within your sleep, or are you sleeping more soundly straight through the night? And then lastly, because of the importance tying into your circadian rhythm, the last pillar is regularity. So
yeah.
I think checking all four of those pillars is really important. And I think those things together make up what would be really optimal sleep.
Okay, yeah, no, that's good. And that, I mean, that obviously touches on, I mean, a lot of different things. I mean, I guess, you know, just kind of some misconceptions about sleep that tie into that. I mean, you hear, you know, people try to make up for lost sleep over the weekend, or, you know, people think that they don't, you know, genetically they're, you know, special and they don't need as much sleep, or just whatever. You know, we grew up in a, and I don't know how your dad was growing up, but my dad definitely had some puritanical Christian influences, and like, you know, sleeping too much was a sign of laziness. And so,
yeah, and it's still that way in a lot of circles.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. So I guess what are some of the, I mean, when you're working with people, what are some of those misconceptions, those, you know, general misconceptions you think most people have about sleep, or just, you know, excuses that they tell themselves that aren't really accurate?
Sure. So firstly, you touched on it, is the idea that you can get by on much less sleep, right? So 6 hours or less. And there is a very, very, very small percentage of the population that does have a certain gene where they're required to have less sleep, where they can really function optimally on around 5 hours of sleep. But really, the chances of anyone listening being that person or having that gene is very, very small. So for the vast majority, you can't get by on less sleep. You can certainly get by, but you won't function as optimally, for sure. Another thing that I have conversations with people a lot is in regards to snoring. And I think this is an important plug that I always try to include and really emphasize it with people, because it's potentially life-saving. So snoring is not necessarily something that you don't need to worry about. I think it's portrayed as something that's very common and that people don't need to worry about. But snoring, especially on a consistent basis, can be a sign of what's called sleep apnea. So sleep apnea is when you actually have a cessation of breathing in the middle of the night, where your brain is deprived of oxygen for for a few seconds and you stop breathing. And sleep apnea, they're doing more and more studies, again, not to go through the lens of fear, but they're doing tons of studies with sleep apnea where they're correlating 4- and 5-fold risks of just about every chronic disease you can think of with sleep apnea. So if you or someone that you know is snoring, snores regularly, has ever mentioned that they, you know, have trouble breathing in the middle of the night, or they wake up unable to breathe in the middle of the night, that's definitely something that you want to go and get screened out. Typically, it's done by getting a sleep study to rule out sleep apnea.
Okay, yeah. Now, that's another good one. That was one I remember you talking about that caught my attention, because that is one of those things, you know, it's just, you know, snoring is pretty common, and so people don't really think about it. But, yeah, definitely want to make sure that it's not a sign of something more more malicious below the surface there. So, and with the people who can't get enough sleep, it's funny, man. I harp on this all the time. I forget. I think it was on the Joe Rogan podcast or whatever. He said something about if you express the number of people who have this gene statistically, it's zero, right? Like,
yeah.
The odds of you listening to this and having this gene are literally 0%. Like, it is less than I hate even leaving a crack in that door open for people, because you know they will take it.
No, like, people will claim that that's them.
That's them. Sure. That's me. No. Oh no. He said it right there. He said that most people, well, I'm not most people. So I just want to make sure that we slam that door like shut. Yes, the odds of anyone listening to this having that gene is statistically zero. So it's not you.
Don't take that to the bank, and don't, you know, try and emphasize that that's you. And even if, you know, on the very, very, very off chance that was you, you know, it's not to say that you couldn't benefit from really improving the quality of sleep, right? And that's where people tend to really be lacking anyway. Is the actual quality and depth of sleep that they're getting. So,
yeah, no, that's a good point. So it kind of leads us to, you know, that quality of sleep. And I guess the term for it is sleep hygiene. And so I guess how would you describe sleep hygiene and what is that?
Sure. So I actually usually don't like the term sleep hygiene. So to me, the way that I look at what sleep hygiene is, firstly, why I don't like it is because I think it tends to oversimplify it. People get less, you know, things for sleep hygiene without taking, you know, what are the specific variables that may be beneficial to them. And it leaves a lot on the table. But sleep hygiene to me is really just the prioritization to do the things that are most obvious for sleep, right? I.e. screen time, having routines, temperature, which, you know, we can talk about any one of those things. But, you know, if you think about the term hygiene, to have hygiene of any type, right, is you have to prioritize it, which is something that people don't often do with sleep. So that's important. But I think to me, sleep hygiene is just making the prioritization to do the things that we know are glaringly obvious, right? Everybody knows that late night screen time is not going to be beneficial for your sleep. It's something that's been out there for a while, right? But a lot of people don't do it. So I think, again, it's just the prioritization of those things that are the most obvious.
Okay. Yeah. So just basically, and again, this is, and I'll tell you, man, I actually, have a buddy, that I do a jiu-jitsu podcast with. And I have to remind him all the time, like, dude, we're outliers, bro. Like, there are so many things that we take for granted that the vast majority of people out there don't even think about. And so, like, the idea of, like, having a, you know, sleep hygiene, like having an environment that's conducive to sleeping, is something that, you know, I'd be willing to bet there's a lot of people listening to this that haven't necessarily really thought about that, which is why I think what you're doing is so So cool. And like, you know, it's interesting because it is this thing that most people, I don't think, have really considered. And so, you know, with that in mind, you know, what are kind of the, would you say, like, you know, the common mistakes that people make with their sleeping environment that can, you know, have a negative impact on their sleep?
Yeah, sure. So firstly, I think, you know, talking about sleeping environment is talking about, you know, the bedroom environment, the setup that you have for sleep. And usually with the bedroom, my goal with people is two things. So the first thing is to make their bedroom, or try and make their bedroom, as minimalistic as possible, right? So the fewer things that people actually have in their bedroom, whether that's from a technology standpoint or anything that's going to require a lot of attention or require a lot of emphasis, is something that you don't want in the bedroom. I like to really keep the bedroom as minimalistic as possible. And then the second piece to that is to keep their bedroom a powerful trigger for sleep and not for wakefulness. So I tend to discourage people from doing things in their bedroom outside of just sleeping. Your brain is going to be very associative. It's something that you do on a consistent daily basis. So the more that you're doing other activities in the bedroom, whether it's just working on something, reading, watching TV, all of those things, your brain is going to very quickly make the association, and your bedroom all of a sudden becomes this trigger for wakefulness as opposed to being a trigger for sleep. And this is one of the most common problems that I find with people.
Yeah, yeah. Man, it's funny. It reminds me, I'm sure you probably have seen the iPhone commercial where they're advertising their battery life by basically saying, like, yeah, you can just fall asleep while doing something on your phone and the battery will outlast you. And you know that commercial, right? And
yeah, exactly.
I was like, oh my God, I'm like, this is insanity. Like, this is the society that we live in, that this is such a reality that people literally are just like, dude, I fall asleep all the time, just like playing on my phone or answering emails or watching YouTube videos or whatever it is.
Which is a problem for so many different reasons as it pertains to sleep. So, you know, again, taking it back to the idea of, you know, keeping things simple. These are things that people haven't considered. But firstly, the screen time. So you're getting blue light exposure. So if we talk about light on a spectrum, blue light for us signals wakefulness. So it signals the hormones and chemicals in the brain that trigger us to be more awake, and they dampen the hormones and chemicals that signal for us to be more sleepy. So they have the exact opposite effect of what we want. They will blunt the production of melatonin, which I'm sure a lot of people have heard about, but is the hormone of sleep, quote unquote. The other negative side effect to using, for example, a phone in bed and close to bedtime, is that these devices promote a lot of anxiety, a lot of mixed feelings. If you're scrolling through social media, if you're on your email, and a very common thread with people who struggle with sleep is high levels of stress, high levels of anxiety, particularly around bedtime. So anything that promotes that further is also going to be something that you really want to try and avoid.
What do you mean? Watching Fox News while looking through Instagram is not the most conducive thing to get you into the mood for sleeping? I don't know what you're talking about here, Nick. This is crazy talk.
Surprisingly not.
No, huh? All right. Well, I'm going to have to make some adjustments. But no, it's I know what you mean, though. It's funny, though, how many people just take that for granted. They're watching the news. They're on Instagram. And we all know, dude, it's really hard to be on social media and not have some sort of negative like feelings. Like, you really have to be on point when you are interacting with social media to not let yourself get sucked into where you don't want to be. And
it's so difficult. I mean, if you think about it, you're just scrolling through people posting, in most cases, people posting their best moments. If you're just in a very low-key environment and you're not in one of your, you know, best moments or most proud moments, it's inherently going to make you feel, you know, not so great.
Yeah. Dude, you were, yeah, were you in on the whole how they don't have likes, like on Instagram, they don't tell you how many likes are on pictures and stuff in it's Canada and Australia. Both of them, if you know, like here in the US, like you go to Instagram and you see a picture and it says, you know, so and so, and 287 others liked this picture. And yeah, there were a couple people there, one from Canada and one from Australia, and both of them were showed me their Instagram feeds, and it just is like so and so and so and so like this picture, and that's it. You don't see all the likes that get, and it's directly related to the, you know, the mind games that get played by people, like, oh man, you know, 250 people like that and only 3 people liked mine, and then you're like trying to do things to generate as many likes as possible. And so by just taking that element away, I don't know, it's interesting. Did you hear that, or did you see that?
I did actually. I've heard traces of that. I think it's something that they're trying to do across the board. I don't know where they are in the process, but I think it's really interesting, and I'm definitely a proponent of it, and I'm certainly a proponent of it in the context of sleep. You know, most things with sleep really come down to, and we could talk a little more about this, but most things with sleep really come down to learned behaviors and learned associations, right? So, which is good and bad. Good in the sense that because they're learned bad behaviors, they're things that we can certainly change, which is, you know, why I got into coaching. But bad in the sense that a lot of these things really become ingrained habits, and they can be very difficult to break. So.
Yeah, for sure. So I guess with that kind of moving on here, just kind of looking at my notes to keep myself on track here. So I guess one of the things that people will do if they're having trouble sleeping is, you know, again, they're like, man, I'm having trouble falling asleep after watching Fox News, and nothing against Fox News, you know, whatever it is. And so I'll just, you know, take an Ambien or, you know, some sort of over the counter option or something like that. So, talk a little bit about the impact of those options instead of trying to improve your sleep quality through more natural means.
Yeah, so firstly, you know, kind of two disclaimers to this is, you know, firstly, not to bash anyone that currently is using sleeping pills or has used sleeping pills in the past. I think, you know, modern medicine has failed us in a lot of ways as it pertains to sleep, just because doctors haven't really been educated a lot on sleep, and, you know, sleeping pills are sometimes the, you know, the easy way out. And then secondly, if you are currently taking sleeping pills, you know, just going cold turkey off of sleeping pills isn't something that you want to do. You want to make sure you work with a professional to really taper off of them correctly. But the first thing that's important to note with sleeping pills like Ambien and Lunesta or any of these, or also over-the-counter options, things like Tylenol PM, the first thing to understand is that they don't induce what we would call naturalistic sleep. So if you were to be in a sleep lab, there's a lot of things, a lot of different physiological mechanisms that would be going on that would, you know, signify that you are in sleep and that you are in different stages of sleep. Your brainwave activities are different. You have fluctuations in your blood pressure, your heart rate, all of these things. And what we find when someone's on sleeping pills or any of these over-the-counter options, or alcohol, even sometimes people will use alcohol very often as a sleep aid, is you don't have these similar physiological things going on, right? So you don't have the same brain waves. What you're actually producing is sedation, right? It's sedation or drowsiness, which is a completely different story than actual sleep. Okay, so I think that's the first piece. And then, you know, specifically talking more about sleeping pills, and this is very scary as well, is they're starting to be linked more and more to a lot of negative health outcomes long term, right? So specifically when controlling for a lot of other variables, they're linked to incidences of a few different forms of cancer, cancer of the bowel, cancer of the prostate, cancer of the breast. So a lot of negative side effects, a lot of negative health outcomes that come from taking sleeping pills, unfortunately, they tend to often fuel a cycle of dependency as well. And then, you know, they really don't fix the root cause of any of the sleeping issues. And very often when people come off of sleeping pills, you know, they end up with what we call rebound insomnia, where they have the same symptoms that they were having previously, and sometimes even worse. So, you know, the risk reward scale, again, not to bash anyone that's taking them, and be careful when you're coming off of them. But when we look at things on the risk reward scale, you know, the marginal benefits that you get from sleeping pills, if any, are just not worth the potential risks.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And again, I think it's just, there's a misconception among a lot of people that just because it comes from a doctor, that it's okay, that it's safe. And there's just a lot of trust that people put in the medical community that, maybe the medical community doesn't always understand the level of trust. And that there does need to be some education on people's part. But, I think that that's, definitely good for people to know. I mean, you know, man, it's just crazy. We got this society that's fueled. You're on Adderall during the day and you're taking sleeping pills at night. And it's just like, you know, this is not sustainable. Like, that's not a sustainable way to live. So I guess, one of the things that you, mentioned at the talk was melatonin, which is, you know, what people would point to is like, well, this is like a natural, sleep aid. And so, I really liked your perspective on that and your advice on that. So I was hoping you could share that with us.
Sure. Yeah. So melatonin is probably the thing from a supplement standpoint that I definitely get asked about the most. So first, just taking a step back at what melatonin is and what it actually does and what it doesn't do. So melatonin is a hormone that is naturally occurring, right? So it's naturally produced. It goes through a cycle throughout the day, ideally, where you're getting a rise in melatonin starting in the evening and peaking at your typical time of bed. And really what it is it's the signaling hormone for sleep, right? So it's been called the hormone of darkness, right? So basically what melatonin will do when it's produced at the right times and it's produced in the right amounts is it will signal the brain that it's time to initiate sleep. So the first caveat is that it doesn't actually participate in sleep. So it doesn't directly influence your quality of sleep per se, right? So the analogy is to look at a race where melatonin brings you to the start line of that race. It doesn't actually participate in the race itself. So breaking off of that, there's a few problems with melatonin supplementation, right? So that all sounds good, and it sounds like if it's something that helps us to signal sleep, it should be something that we go after. But again, a few problems, and it comes down to the fact that it's not FDA regulated. So there was an interesting study that they did where they compared a lot of different melatonin brands, and they were looking at the actual amount of melatonin that was in the pills, the supplement, relative to what they were claiming. And what they found is it was really all over the place. So everything from, you know, 80% less to up to 400% more than was actually claimed. And, you know, another problem with, you know, the supplementation that people are doing with melatonin is they tend to be taking way more than is actually needed. And I'm always, you know, trying to emphasize that people try to optimize these mechanisms and these hormone balances naturally. And when you take too much synthetic, you know, melatonin, you can actually blunt your body's natural production of melatonin, your body's natural timing and release of melatonin, which is, again, if we come back to that equation of playing the long game, if we're really playing the long game, that's something we really need to be mindful. So not to say that there's no use cases for it and you should never use it. I think if you're using it in the right amount, which, you know, 1 milligram, 2 milligram, 3 milligram at the absolute most, and if you're using it in conjunction with all of the behavioral things that we'll talk about, I think it can be okay. But just being mindful, again, of the fact that the dosing and amount will really vary.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, I think that's good. Good advice, because again, that's just one of those common things that people will point to. And again, I know, man, we're coaches. We know how it is. Literally, if someone can take a pill and get the same results, like they'll do it. And you know, I would too, right? Like I tell people, I say,
Course.
I don't like working out. I mean, there's things I get out of working out, but I want the results from working out so I can go play and like do the things that I want to do. And so, yeah, it gets, you know, people like to look for that, literally that pill that they can
Sure.
take and not have to put
Yeah,
in
there is
the work.
because sleep, like we talked about, has so many things going on in the body and so many benefits and all these different things occurring there. There is no pill. There is no one pill that you can take that will replicate all of those things. And I don't know that there necessarily ever will be. So melatonin included in that equation, unfortunately. So, in specific use cases like jet lag, like when you're traveling, it can be it can be helpful to help with your signaling of time for sleep when you're really thrown off your typical clock, and things along those lines. But I'm always a proponent of people trying the behavioral means first, and then you can always come back to some of these other things.
Yeah. So was that what, I mean, what, how did melatonin get its popularity? I mean, were there studies that were done and, you know, on kind of some of these specific use cases and got misconstrued, or was it, you know, just purely conjecture?
I think what probably popularized it first was an increasing amount of just sleep research that was being done in general, and it being educated to the public a little bit more, which I think is great, which is something that I'm very passionate about doing. The more that people are educated about sleep and why it's important and how it occurs, the better. And then, as with many things, the supplement industry takes that information and really runs with it. I haven't really come across any studies that, and I've taken a deep dive on this, I haven't come across any studies in particular that are looking at melatonin supplementation as getting these dramatic improvements in sleep quality that would, that would indicate its further use.
Yeah.
Actually, a lot of the success, if any, that people may have had with it tends to be pretty placebo in nature. So
Yeah,
again, I think it's just one of those instances where, the supplement industry takes something and really runs with it.
no, they've definitely been known to do that before. So, is anyone who's taken boron to try to promote their testosterone because there was a study that showed that it helped postmenopausal women do it, can attest.
Yeah.
Yes. But anyways, fucking Joe Weider, that bastard got more of my money as a kid than I want to admit. Anyways, so yeah, that's interesting. And again, I think that placebo effect, you know, that's a double-edged sword, right? Like if you're taking something and it's not causing you harm, right? If you're only taking like 1 or 2 milligrams, like you were
No, yeah.
saying, so you know, you're not messing with your long-term production or something. And if it is just a placebo effect, like, hey man,
Yeah, don't underestimate the placebo effect for sure.
I'm not gonna argue with you, but don't come
Sure.
at everyone saying like, yo, melatonin's the answer to every sleep problem, kind of
Sure.
thing. So
Yeah, anything that's not harmful on that risk reward scale where, people are getting some type of perceived benefit, I'm a proponent of it as long as the risk is, very low, if not minimal completely. So yeah, I'm definitely a proponent of those things. I think if there's one common thread with, for example, people who have insomnia, it's an overactive fight or flight sympathetic nervous system. It's, increased anxiety around sleep that just becomes fueled over time. So anything that diminishes that has very low risk is always going to be something of benefit. So
nice. Cool. All right. So this leads me to my next question. And this is something, I live in Colorado and being the first state to legalize, marijuana and, you know, CBD has been legal for a while, but it's definitely gotten way more popular, over the last year or so. And so, especially edibles, people using THC edibles and then either CBD edibles or you know the tinctures or oils or whatever, but using those either separately or in conjunction or whatever to help with sleep. And I've heard different takes on this, and so I was really curious to get your thoughts and see if you seen any data or anything on what kind of the impacts that they have on that.
Sure. Yeah. So if we break if we break these up, unfortunately, at least from everything that I have seen and every bit of research, which firstly, there's taking a step back, there's I think this is an area because it's so new and developing that there's going to be a lot more research that comes out, and these studies take place over a long time, and so I think there's going to be a lot more that comes out on this. But everything that I've seen and heard and read so far, from the standpoint of THC, tends to have negative effects on sleep. So in particular, very similar to what alcohol will do, is it's shown that THC will actually rob you of your REM sleep, your rapid eye movement sleep, or your dream sleep. This is the sleep that tends to be, your emotional regulator. So keeping good mental health and REM sleep kind of takes a back seat to some of the deeper stages of sleep, but REM sleep is incredibly important for you as well. So THC tends to fit into the same bucket in the sense that it robs you of a good portion of your REM sleep. So CBD, on the other hand, is something that has a bit of a more positive outlook, although the jury is still out. So anecdotally, I've seen some good results. And I think this comes back to, again, that most issues with sleep tend to be centered around stress and anxiety. And if there's an area where CBD has been well worked out and well researched, it's in the context of anxiety. But overall, the research with CBD and sleep is growing. The caveat to it is really the dosing. So the amount of CBD is very important and tends to be very specific. So too much or too little, and you can see no effects, or actually opposite effects of what you want. But incidents, initially where the dosing is right, we actually are seeing a good potential where CBD can improve the quality of sleep. But I think we won't know more until we get more of this research coming in and we get a better idea of the specific dosing. So
Okay. All right. Good to know. So what you're telling me is I shouldn't be sitting there smoking a joint, drinking a beer, watching Fox News, looking around on Instagram right before I'm trying to go to bed. All right. So I'm adding to the list of things to not do right before I go to sleep.
I mean, that's what I'm doing as soon as I hop off this call. So I don't,
Right. Sounds like a fun afternoon.
yeah.
Anyway, so all right, cool. And then I guess just kind of wrapping up, I want to touch on a few other things, but the just kind of with supplements, are there any supplements or things that you have found that do help with sleep?
Yeah, so again, not to beat a dead horse, I think it comes back to, I'm always a proponent of trying the natural approach first, in the sense that, trying to check those behavioral boxes and sleep hygiene boxes first. I'd rather someone go through that first. I think probably the area of supplementation that, is most indicated and where I've seen the best results is anything that's going to promote relaxation. So again, the dosing with CBD is important, but CBD fits into that bucket. Things like valerian root, right? Anything that's promoting relaxation, I think, is going to be the most efficacious. Again, coming back to that idea that people have an overactive sympathetic or fight or flight nervous system that makes sleep that much more difficult for them. So anything that's going to be, a lot of the essential oils that will promote relaxation, I think, can be beneficial. But I think there's also a lot of supplements that people should be wary of, just like the supplement industry in general, where, it can be very misleading.
Yeah. Okay. Excellent. Cool, man. Well, I guess shifting gears a little bit, getting away from like the supplements and stuff like that. Like, so what are three things that you would say people could do today to improve their sleep quality?
Sure. So firstly, my top three categories, basically in order, in regards to my sleep coaching and what I do with people, is step one is the behavioral, right? So the behavioral aspect of sleep. The second is what we call circadian entrainment, which is basically getting in close alignment with what your circadian rhythm is, which we can talk a little bit about. And then lastly is your lifestyle and environment. So if I was going to, you know, pick just three things, you know, kind of the top three things, I would say number one is to prioritize sleep. And this is seemingly obvious, but you have to tell yourself that sleep is important for your goals and for your long-term health, right? Viewing things through that lens of health first, but this is where it starts in order to make the changes necessary, just like anything else. So regardless of what you want to accomplish, sleep will provide a benefit. So you have to just have that prioritization for sleep first, right? I can give people a list of a lot of different hygiene things that they can do, but if they haven't really bought into why sleep is so important and really prioritize it in their life, you know, a lot of those other things aren't going to happen. The second piece is to hack, again, what we call your circadian clock. So basically, everybody has their own 24-hour internal clock where there will be preferences in when they would like to be awake, when they would like to be asleep, as well as many other physiological processes in your body. When your blood pressure rises, when your blood pressure falls, when certain hormones rise and fall, when you'd ideally be working out, when you'd ideally be eating, all of these things, your body likes rhythm. So all of these things ideally will fall on a clock. So breaking off of that is something that's called your chronotype. So everybody has genetically a specific chronotype, which is an expression of that circadian rhythm, where it's individualized to you. And this is where people have typically talked about, you know, night owls or morning larks. This is a genetic setup. I recommend everybody check out the book, The Power of When, and the chronotypes that are specifically referenced there. So go through the quiz that's associated with it, find out what your chronotype is and how to try and fit key activities, including sleep, to that as closely as possible. And then lastly, you know, the third tip would be temperature. And only because I think relative to a lot of the other things that are talked about, temperature is the thing that doesn't get as much attention or hasn't been fully accepted as much. So try for a few weeks dropping your temperature down a few degrees and really notice how you sleep and how you feel.
Yeah. I've actually, it's funny, man, I've got a chili pad on the way. So should be here Friday. I was, yeah.
Game changer. It's a life changer.
Yeah. So for people that don't know, the chili pad is basically like a little mattress pad you put on your side of the bed, and it's water that is cooled or heated to, so basically it's like a thermostat for your side of the bed. You can set exactly what you want the temperature to be on your side of the bed. And for anyone who is woken up in the middle of the night just burning up, and it's like, well, how the hell do you keep it from getting so damn hot underneath these covers? So, yeah, I'm really looking forward to that.
Awesome. Also, anyone who has argued with a spouse about the temperature, the temperature in your house, or which is something that I definitely can relate to. So it's a potentially fight saver as well, or a disagreement saver as well.
Yeah.
So the temperature stuff is really interesting. Firstly, your brain and your body, your core temperature needs to drop a few degrees in order to initiate sleep and in order to stay asleep. Also, temperature is a very powerful regulator of that circadian clock that we talked about. So, you know, in addition to light, movement, nutrition, temperature is a very powerful powerful indicator of your circadian clock, or manipulator of your circadian clock, that we really have deprived ourselves of in modern society, right? We're in controlled thermostats that are basically at the same temperature all day, and we don't get any rise and fall that triggers, you know, wakefulness or sleep in that way. So
yeah, no, it's and you said 65 degrees is what the research.
Yeah, that tends to be what research will point to as having the, you know, the fastest time to fall asleep, the deepest percentages of, you know, deep sleep quality. But, you know, there is a difference person to person. So if you're typically having your, you know, your house set at you know, for example, 75 degrees, 65 obviously may be a big jump. So you want to just gradually regress that temperature or lower that temperature a little bit. Another powerful thing to do with temperature is to make it gradual throughout the evening, right? So don't just drop the thermostat right at time of bed. The more that that signal is gradual throughout the evening, the better. So you can kind of drop it 1 degree every hour.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's that's good. I think that temperature thing is an important one that people may not necessarily consider. So good, man, good. So we touched a little bit on some of the basic things that better sleep will do for you, but you know, obviously there's a lot of mountain bikers listening to this. So I guess from an athlete's perspective, what is going to be the impact of improving their sleep? Like, you know, health is great, but let's be honest, better Strava times are what it's all about. I'm saying that tongue in cheek, obviously, because I laugh at that mindset, but it is, people want to improve their performance. And so, you know, and I've definitely learned myself that trying to sell people prevention is tough. They want to know, how is this going to help me ride faster? So I think there's definitely some interesting impacts that sleep has on people's performance that they may not consider. So why don't you elaborate on some of those things?
Sure. So, I mean, sleep really is going to impact every facet of your physical performance. So all of the things that are going to go into mountain biking and all of the things that are going to go into physical activity in general are going to be influenced by sleep in some way, shape, or form. So, you know, there's studies that have correlated sleep directly, your sleep quality directly with your endurance and your ability to go longer, right? That time to fatigue, your reaction times, your power output, your strength. And this, you know, we can see deficits in these areas and even just one night of sleep. And then, you know, sleep loss, there's some studies that have been done where sleep loss dramatically increases your incidence of injuries and injury risk, right? So, you know, that has to be the number one thing. Obviously, if you're injured, you can't ride. Specifically, you know, to mountain biking, I think the boost in alertness that you get, the boost in focus are going to, you know, really give you much better ability to be able to read a trail a hell of a lot better. There's studies that have been done that are going to correlate sleep directly with balance, right? They looked at the amount of deep sleep that people got and then measured their balance specifically to that. And they saw a correlative relationship there. So really just every facet of performance is going to be impacted in some way by sleep, either enhanced when you get it or, you know, impaired when you don't. So I think the piece breaking off of that is those impacts of your circadian rhythms on performance as well. So, you know, finding out what your chronotype is and a little bit more about that, you know, there's an ideal time when you'll have your best reaction time, you'll have your best coordination, your most alertness. So depending on what your individual chronotype and what your individual clock is and your sport, you know, you may be able to kind of pick and choose when the best times to train are, and obviously sleep and circadian health are going to go hand in hand on that.
Yeah, no, I think that, you know, all good points, because yeah, especially like the balance, you know, the reaction time stuff, the decision-making, like these are all things that, you know, mountain bikers may not necessarily consider because, you know, we're always so concerned about cardio, right? So like cardio is such a huge part of training. And, you know, one of the things I'm, you know, I was trying to get mountain bikers to understand is that, you know, that your skills have a big impact on your performance, both from an efficiency standpoint and also from a safety standpoint. And so, you know, those things are directly impacted by, you know, obviously endurance is as well, but that aspect, I don't think a lot of riders really realize how much a lack of sleep affects their motor skills and reaction time and things like that. So, yeah, that's like you're saying,
exactly.
best performance enhancing drug.
Exactly. You know, and sleep does improve your conditioning and improves your time to fatigue, your aerobic output in general as well. And, you know, the beauty of sleep, like you touched on right at the beginning, it's that one lever that you can pull to influence all of these things. So, you know, we'll still have to train balance to a certain extent and train these motor skills. And, you know, they're of crucial importance. You know, you have this lever in sleep that is going to allow you to spend less time having to work on those things. You have this one lever that's going to influence and improve all of these variables that are going to improve your performance and, you know, decrease your incidence of injury. So,
yeah. Yeah, no, it's it is. It's like I said, it's that low hanging fruit that's sitting there. Just I don't think a lot of people realize that it's there, and they don't know how to pick it, you know, and really take advantage of it the way that they should. So, so I did actually want to the chronotypes was one of those things I do encourage everybody to check that out. But another thing, because I just man, you know how this is, man. If you've been doing this, you know, coaching for long enough, you realize that. That people will look for any crack in the door to use as an excuse. So like the chronotypes, so even if you find out that you're a night owl or a wolf, right, as the chronotype may be, that does not mean that you want, that's not an excuse to stay up till 2 o'clock playing video games, right?
Sure. Yeah, there's the extremes, and you know, the differences in these chronotypes, they are a genetic predisposition, and you know, there's not a lot of ways to necessarily manipulate them. You have to know which one you are and stay within the confines of that. But the differences are not, you know, 6-7 hours and when you should be going to sleep. It's more different than, you know, 2 or 3 hours where, you know, the wolf should be potentially going to bed at midnight or, you know, 12:30, not, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning or 4 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, lions, who are the early risers, don't have to be going to bed at 7 p.m. You know, it's more along the lines of 9:30, 10 o'clock. So,
yeah,
you know, even the two extremes, there's not as much of a drastic difference as people will sometimes, you know, paint it out to be. So,
yeah, nice. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure we touched on that because, again, it's I love talking to people and watch them go, well, that's me. I'm a night owl and I don't need much sleep. And it's like, no.
Yeah. You still need the same amount. It's just, your clock is just pushed back a little bit more maybe than someone else, but you still need the same prioritization of sleep. You still need the same quality of sleep as everyone else. So
yeah. Nice. Good. Yeah. But, all right. So I got a random question for you, and are you familiar with like the second sleep? Like the two sleeps, like there was a period where, you know, in Victorian times or whatever, where they'd sleep and then wake up in the middle of the night you know, and then go back to bed. So what is that, man?
So if you look back evolutionarily and you look back in a lot of different societies of the past, it biphasic sleep, which is two periods of sleep time, was not actually uncommon. And actually, in a lot of areas of the world, not a lot of areas of the world, but in certain areas of the world, you know, areas that will close the entire town to have a nap in the middle of the day, there's still elements of this that are still around. And I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing. The problem is that, you know, in the society that we're in, we can't replicate this with any type of consistency. So I think that's where we kind of did away with that. But, you know, that kind of goes into, you know, the controversial topic of naps and where naps can play in, and, you know, should you be sleeping, you know, in a block of more than one time per day? And again, one of the most important things that you can do for sleep and for health in general is to keep things regular, as many variables as you can keep regular. And this biphasic form of sleep just tends to be very hard for people to replicate. You know, they can't sleep at the same time during the day to take a nap. So I think in a lot of cases, because of that, it can end up doing more harm than good.
Ah, okay. Interesting. So it's just an extreme version of naps. All right.
Yeah.
That brings it. So it's funny. It's something that, God, I forget where I first came across it. I think I've got a Rolfer massage guy here who, you know, like most of these guys, is an interesting cat. And, when he was in Germany and he was telling me about like the second sleep thing or something. I love reading like old history and stuff, like old Greek and Roman history. And if you look for it, like you can see some references to that. And people talk about it almost like it was just like, well, everyone does this. You know, this is just a normal thing that, you know, there's kind of these two sleep periods.
It's just the extreme of it. Like you said, I think, you know, there's there's still pieces of it that are still around. I don't know of any, you know, cultures that still have the extreme of it where they're sleeping, you know, say 4 hours at one block and then 4 hours at another block.
Yeah.
But, you know, definitely in certain parts of Europe and other parts of the world, you know, it's very common to have everything in the town shut down from, say, you know, 12 to 2 o'clock because everyone's home taking that nap.
Yeah,
they're
man.
They're able to replicate that with consistency, and everybody is staying on the same rhythm with that. So,
yeah.
Okay. And I would probably, you know, I'd probably say they probably have less, you know, less incidence of sleep issues. But
yeah, for sure. I mean, if you're willing to shut things down, you're also just not as stressed out. You know, it's different priorities. That's interesting. Man, I'm just trying to think if there was another question that had popped into my head and then it went away. But I'll tell you, like, I definitely just personally came back and made a few changes. I got some blackout curtains for my room. It was one of those things that, like, I've had blackout curtains before and we moved into a new house, and it's amazing how all of a sudden you're like, dude, I've been in this house for almost 2 years and I have not gotten the curtains yet. And so, yeah. I got the blackout curtains. I got one of those, the daylight alarm, clocks as awesome. Well. And so that has been working well. I have not overslept. Does it wakes you up, especially if you have a dark room. Like, that's what I found out. Like, if you have a dark room, then the light alarm obviously works really well because you're like, what the hell is that light?
That's the best. Yeah, that's the best combination, is when you can really, you know, channel getting that complete darkness at nighttime, and then you get, you know, some form of a natural light like that daylight lamp waking you up. You get the best of both worlds. So
yeah. And if people aren't familiar with it, the daylight alarm is just that. It's a alarm. It's got a light, and it you know, over the course of like 10, 15 minutes or whatever, goes from pretty, not very bright at all to bright, and it kind of simulates the sunrise, I guess, is what the goal is. And so, definitely much more pleasant way to wake up than a screeching, alarm clock or my phone. So let me ask you a question with the phones. What is your thoughts on, so I need to just get a white noise machine, which is the answer to my question. But when you do, you know, need to use your phone, like if you're traveling or whatever, like I've heard that, turning it on airplane mode, can help. That's one of the things, I mean, people forget, like that freaking phone is always sending things out and receiving things all the time, and you're placing the damn thing right by your head.
Yeah, EMF can be, you know, very disruptive to certain brainwave states of sleep and to disruption and quality of sleep. So, you know, turning off your Wi-Fi, putting in airplane mode can definitely be, can be beneficial. You know, it comes back to an ideal world. You at least have it on the opposite side of the room, if not, you know, out of the room completely, and having something like a daylight lamp or, you know, one of those old school alarm clocks that has very minimal light and something that's going to wake you up that way, as opposed to having to rely on your phone to be woken up.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's good advice. So, but yeah, it's definitely made an impact. Just I didn't realize how much light was coming in the room just from the moon. You know, just it's freaking bright out here in the desert. And and then the daylight alarm has been good. So, and I got my chili pad on the way. Really looking forward to that. So, one of the things that you touched on, I thought was an interesting point, was sleep trackers. That's something that, people may be wondering about, like how, you know, if I'm wanting to improve my sleep, would a sleep tracker be useful in that? So I really liked your advice on those. So what's kind of your view on using, you know, different fitness trackers for tracking sleep?
Right. With sleep trackers, as with a lot of things in the health and wellness industry, I think it really depends. So for me personally, you know, I'll work with a lot of people that obviously have sleep issues specifically. And I think for someone who has sleep issues, meaning either, you know, you're not getting the right amount of sleep that you think you should be getting, you're having trouble falling asleep or staying asleep, I typically at the onset will discourage someone from using sleep trackers just because I think in a lot of instances they tend to promote more anxiety, more stress around sleep, which is what the opposite of what we want, especially at the beginning. I think for someone who has generally healthy sleep and is just looking to optimize it from the standpoint of performance or whatever it may be, I think there's, you know, some benefit in having it. They tend to be pretty accurate at estimating the duration of sleep, the actual amount of time that you're asleep. But once you start to get into, you know, the breaking between stages of sleep, they tend to not be very accurate. So, you know, you don't want to put too much stock in that necessarily, but they are consistently inaccurate. So, you know, if you start using it, what they can do is they can bring a lot of awareness to how certain lifestyle variables will impact your sleep, i.e., you know, caffeine, alcohol, you know, what the timing of when you exercise, the timing of when you eat, and you can start to see how these things, you know, impact your baseline of sleep. So I think from the standpoint of bringing awareness in that context, I think they can be beneficial.
Yeah, no, I like that. It was good point. I actually came back and put my Fitbit back on and started using it because it's more about the big picture trend over time, and then it is like really trying to worry about how accurate a single day is. And so yeah, I thought that was a really good way to look at using them, because it gives you some objective way to see how things are impacting, especially if you're trying to improve your sleep quality and having some objective way to measure if things are impacting it or having a negative impact on it, I think is always good. So I thought that was
definitely. I think there's still a lot of benefit in using, you know, your subjective measurements as well. You know, how you feel when you wake up, you know, all of that is, I think, really, really beneficial as well. What's your energy level throughout the day? What's your mood? You know, tagging these things after certain nights of sleep, I think is really impactful as well.
Yeah, for sure. That's definitely having the big picture. And, you know, we're both fans of the you know, Morpheus HRV system. I mean, I assume that you're using it as well, seeing as that you're at Joel's thing. That HRV app has, you know, the Morpheus Recovery app, I think is a really good, it's such a great tool. I've been using it, man, probably, I had the original BioForce one and I stopped using it. I mean, just to be honest with you, because I just kept running into so many problems with it dropping my heart rate. And so the new Morpheus band and that works 100% better. I haven't had any issues with it. And so I got back into using it about a year ago, and I really like how it, you know, especially if you have some sort of fitness tracker, that it pulls in like your sleep, your steps, you can track your training, it's tracking your HRV, your resting heart rate, it's asking you, you know, to when you're waking up in the mornings, like, you know, what was your sleep quality? It's, you know, is your subjective feeling on it, you know, how sore are you? What's your, you know, how are you feeling? And so even just having something that makes you just aware of these things. But yeah, those subjective, having that mix of objective and subjective data is really that's the best of both worlds. That's what you want. And then learning how to use that to help guide your training decisions and things like that. Because, you know, if you don't get enough sleep and you wake up the next morning and your HRV is tanked and, you know, it's, you can see it, you have something there. Plus you feel like crap. So, you know, like, oh, wow. But anyways, that's just kind of, I'm always trying to encourage people to use that mix, because RPE and that subjective data is great, but having some objective data. But so what I guess, what's your is that, that been kind of your experience with the HRV stuff?
Yeah, so you know, like I mentioned at the beginning, I mean, HRV was one of the things that originally got me into sleep. And you know, you start to, the biggest thing with having both subjective and objective is you're just focused on connecting the dots. You're just trying to piece the to piece the things together in terms of how you feel, how you perform, and how those things align with the numbers that you see. So, you know, Morpheus is definitely the best one that I've come across that compiles all of those things into one into one algorithm and gives people a very, you know, tangible, practical, you know, takeaway in terms of how much you should push yourself or not, and, you know, how much you should be prioritizing your recovery. So I think things like that in the context of sleep are great. If, you know, again, I sometimes will work with people with acute sleep issues. So if you're really acutely struggling with sleep, you know, falling asleep, staying asleep, sometimes it's best to cut those things out at the onset, because when you're not getting the right numbers, they, again, just promote a lot of anxiety and tend to perpetuate things a little bit. But then once you've established a better baseline and kind of worked through some of those initial issues, coming back to that, and, you know, I think is awesome.
Yeah, that's fine. I tell people all the time that numbers have power, so you got to be careful what numbers you give power to. And
I think inherently, you know, people know if what type of personality they are. Are you the type that that does better with having numbers and having something to work off of, or do those numbers tend to give you a little more stress, where you're worrying about what those numbers are and they really frustrate you when they're not where they should be? And so you have to just know what type of personality you are in that context. So
yeah, no doubt, man, no doubt. So. Well, right on. It's I've gotten through all the questions I had down for you. Can't really think of anything else, man. I know we're gonna. Is there any other just kind of things you want to touch on, or anything else that you thought would be good for people to know about, either just, you know, sleeping or whatever in general?
I mean, not necessarily. This obviously it's a topic that I can talk about for hours and hours, so I can keep going down the rabbit hole and keep going. But I think we kind of touched on the big rocks, which is awesome and which is a good, you know, good starting point for people. So
the science of sleep, I mean, that's one of the things, again, just understanding like how it works, you know, what's involved, you know, how different things impact it, that there's a lot of it's one of these burgeoning areas, you know, that people are becoming more aware of, and guys like you are going to, I think, serve a bigger and bigger role in helping to educate people on that. So, you know, kind of with that said, you know, people were interested in learning more and, you know, getting a hold of you, you know, what's the best way for people to find you and learn more about what you do?
Yeah, so it's all through the brand of the online sleep coach, where, you know, really my goal and emphasis is just to do exactly what you mentioned, just educate people more on sleep, to bring sleep more into the forefront of the coaching world and into the realm of health and wellness and performance. So, you know, on Instagram, I'm Online Sleep Coach. The website is onlinesleepcoach.com. Email is onlinesleepcoach@gmail.com. So really just through that Online Sleep Coach brand, I provide speaking engagements and lots of things like this, where I'm just trying to provide general education and awareness around sleep. I obviously do a lot of things in the context of one-on-one coaching. So I do a one-on-one virtual coaching for sleep, where we dive into specifically the variables for you that you need to improve for sleep. And sometimes it's just a matter of working together once. Sometimes we, you know, we'll go a few more sessions. I also do virtual group coaching sessions, where it'll be, say, anywhere from 4 to 6 week block, where everybody has the same sleep issue, for example, insomnia, and we kind of go through a meeting weekly. It's a little shameless plug about, you know, some coaching services and for sleep that I offer. And
yeah, man, you got a couple projects that you're working on. You know, it looks like one you're looking at trying to create something to help the end user, and then also something to help coaches or people who are interested in adding sleep coaching to you know, the services that they're offering. Is that right?
Yeah, so the, you know, the first thing that I'm working on, and I hopefully have these both of these things done by the end of the year. The first thing that I'm working on is a program. You know, maybe it'll be a either 5 or 6 week program that people can go through, and it basically takes all of what we know about sleep and all of what we know on how to optimize sleep, and really tries to, you know, condense it down into a very practical, easy to implement program that people can go through for 5 or 6 weeks, regardless of their background, whether they have sleep issues or they just want to optimize their sleep for performance, or they just want to learn more. You know, you can go through this program and it kind of hits all of the big rocks, and it's very practical and easy for people to implement. And then the second thing is, you know, I'm trying to bring sleep more into the forefront of the coaching world. So I'm trying to have more sleep coaches be available to help people out. So I'm putting together a certification course specifically for coaches, trainers, practitioners who, you know, either want to go the route of offering sleep coaching, or they just want to learn more about it to be able to better educate their clients, patients, etc.
Nice, man. No, it's good. Like I said, it's one of those areas that needs guys like you doing this work because unfortunately, like a lot of things, I think people are gonna see it's kind of like life coaching, right? Like all of a sudden you turn around and all these people are life coaches, and it's like, well, what the hell makes you a life coach? And you realize like they just thought it would be cool. And
Yeah,
so
exactly.
I think that sleep coaching.
Unfortunately, the coaching world is very diluted, and you just put anything in front of the word coach. And but I think, you know, the way I look at it is, if we, you know, if we value sleep the same way that we value exercise and nutrition, you know, as those three pillars of health, there's no reason why, you know, sleep isn't something that we'd be coaching up. It requires all of those same elements, and there's, you know, there's no shortage of trainers and strength coaches and nutrition coaches, but obviously a shortage of sleep coach, and you know, people out there that can truly help people through their specific sleep issues.
No, for sure. Like I said, I think it's gonna be one of those things that people will hear more and more about, and that you'll have people who don't necessarily know what they're talking about starting to talk. And so having guys like you out there helping to lay the groundwork and educate people about these things in the right way, I think is super important. So one of the reasons I wanted to get you on, and I find this stuff fascinating because, again, like as a kid, I just always thought how you can manipulate your body to get it to do what you want. And originally, it was through strength training, right? Like I do bicep curls and my biceps get bigger, and then Susie looks at me a little bit more. But it's realizing there's so many other things that impact it, and sleep is one of those things that I've definitely been getting more into. And so your presentation was really inspiring. So yeah, I appreciate you coming on and sharing some insights with us.
Yeah, absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks a lot for having me on. It was great to talk about this stuff.
No, for sure. And you and I will be in touch. I'll see about having you maybe contribute some stuff to the website and get some articles and other stuff up. Because I think this is definitely something a lot of people can benefit from. And you, my friend, obviously know way more than I do about it. So I'd just rather point people in your direction. So yeah, people are interested in learning more, go to the onlinesleepcoach.com or hit them up on Instagram at the online sleep coach. And give them a follow and stay tuned for more because there will be more coming. So man, anything else before we go?
No, that's it, man. Thanks again. Much appreciated. And like you said, we'll definitely continue to collaborate and talk soon.
Perfect. All right. Well, I'm going to stop recording. So yeah, we'll talk to everybody later.